Distinguished speakers, ladies and gentlemen, I'm pleased to be given the opportunity to share some insights on the vulnerability of the Pacific Islands fisheries sector and share some of Fiji's experiences. The special relationship Pacific Islanders have with the ocean is well recognized. Our islands are scattered across the vast Pacific Ocean, which covers almost half of the Earth's surface, sea surface. We have more ocean than we have landmass. In Fiji, the area of our exclusive economic zone, or EEZ, is 70 times more than our landmass. For some of our neighboring island states, the ratio goes into the thousands. The Pacific Island is the largest ecosystem in the world, holding the largest stocks of tuna, a rich diversity and stocks of sharks, reef fish, marine mammals, and turtles, with an extensive coral reef system. Most Pacific Islands communities rely on the ocean for food security and diverse livelihood opportunities. Local coastal Pacific communities receive 50 to 90% of their animal source protein from fish. Inshore and coastal fisheries is a primary or secondary source of income for up to 50% of households in the Pacific region, and at the national level is estimated to contribute 49% of the total fisheries contribution to the GDP. As you can see, the socioeconomic contribution of coastal fisheries in Pacific Island states is quite significant. Unfortunately, studies indicate 75% of Pacific Island countries and territories will not meet their food security needs by 2030 due to a forecast of 50% growth in population, limited productivity of coastal fisheries as a result of climate change, exacerbated by overfishing, and inadequate national distribution networks. This projected decrease will widen the gap between fish available for growing human populations and sustainable harvests. To ensure food security and strengthen resilience, strategies and innovative actions need to be taken to reduce the dependence of coastal communities on marine resources. Diversification into other forms of livelihoods, for instance, will be necessary. However, this needs to be carried out without compromising or exploiting other resources. Instead, such diversification should be planned to protect or enhance marine ecosystems and resources. Such an initiative is a holistically planned blue carbon project which should benefit local communities. Ladies and gentlemen, offshore commercial fisheries is also a major contributor to our national GDP. In Pacific small island states, the fishing industry contributes up to 10% of total GDP. Most of our small islands have agreements with large fishing fleets and a few have fish processing plants. Of the total 2.4 million tons of tuna caught in the Western Pacific Ocean, 58% have been caught in waters of Pacific SIDS, generating a total of USD $2.8 billion. However, it is recognized that climate change impacts would alter the fishing industry in Pacific SIDS. Faster warming water around the equator will drive marine species into cooler waters. Species from warmer waters will replace those traditionally caught in many fisheries worldwide. These shifts would result in the loss of traditional fisheries, decrease in catch, decrease in profits and jobs, and overall food security concerns. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to share some examples on how the fisheries sector in Fiji was affected when a Category 5 tropical cyclone, Winston, devastated the country. Cyclone Winston struck Fiji in February 2016 and was the strongest cyclone on record to make landfall in the Southern Hemisphere. Damage to the fisheries subsector was valued at over 40.7 million Fijian dollars, representing 51% of total damage to the agriculture sector. The most significant affected areas were the coastal subsistence fisheries, with a value of Fijian dollars 24.7 million, accounting for about 68% of total damage in the subsector. Coastal commercial fisheries sustained damage amounting to 5.3 million Fijian dollars, 13%, while damage to aquaculture was valued at 3.7 million, so 9.5%. Out of the 23 existing government stations, 13 of them sustained damage at a cost of 3.8 million. As seen from the data above, the local coastal communities who rely heavily on coastal fisheries for the food security and livelihoods were the most affected. Assessments carried out indicated that fisheries resources may take more than 10 years to recover. The multitude of impacts extending beyond the sector would also be factored in. In Fiji, the town of Levuka, the government-owned Pacific fishing company, or PAFCO, as we call it in Fiji, is a loining and canning facility and produces cooked frozen albacore loins that are shipped to the canning facility in California. Some canning is also done for the local market. The facility employs around 900 locals, where about 60% of employees are women. The volume and value of canned fish exported by Fish has been substantially increasing. For the period of 2011 to 2012, there was around $2.4 million Fijian dollars in exports for around for the period 2013 to 2014, this jumped to $22.4 million Fijian dollars. Obviously, after Winston, production took a sharp dive as a result of many factors. These include wharfs being substantially damaged, making it impossible for boats to berth. Tuna had to be offloaded at the country's capital in Suva and transported to Levuka, at great cost given that Levuka is on a different island. Fuel for the capacity also had to be trucked in from Suva. Water infrastructure in the nearby communities were also damaged, and these communities relied heavily on PAFCO's own reservoir, placing additional strain on vital supply of fresh water to the facility. Ladies and gentlemen, as seen from the examples given above, the impacts of climate change on our fisheries sector is varied. This includes the warming and changing chemistry of our ocean, the increasing intensity of weather events, the change in marine life behavior, and the degradation of coastal ecosystems. And all these aggravated by a fast-growing population and irresponsible human behavior. The livelihoods and food security of our local communities and national economies are at risk. This in turn means that meeting the substantial development goals, the sustainable development goals, will be a challenge, if at all possible. There is an urgent need to take mitigation and adaptation action to address these many threats. To not deal with these threats jeopardizes the very survival of our small island developing states. In recognition of this urgency to act, the Fiji COP23 presidency, together with partners in the Pacific, established the Ocean Pathway, a strategy for the ocean into COP23. The Ocean Pathway Partnership was launched in November 2017 during COP23 in Bonn, Germany. The partnership calls for formal recognition to the critical links between the ocean and climate change. The partners of the Ocean Pathway will work to give prominence to the role of the ocean in the UN FCCC process over the next 2 years. The Pathway Partnership also recognizes the need to include oceans' nationally determined contributions and to ensure climate financing can support the work required for healthy oceans. We welcome your engagement in this partnership. Ladies and gentlemen, it is crucial that we push for stronger recognition of the vulnerability of our fisheries sector to climate change. We need to identify effective strategies and take urgent action to strengthen resilience. The lives of Pacific Island communities depend on this. Naka.
Thank you, Mr. Tavaga. You stuck to the time limit extremely well, so I particularly appreciate that. Next, I'd like to invite Mr. Dong Jinhe from the Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Affairs of the People's Republic of China to give the next presentation.
Dear Mr. Director General, distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Because of no Chinese simultaneous interpretation, so on behalf of Mr. Dong Jinhe, I would like to make a brief introduction on the current status and management policies of aquatic resources of Yangtze River. Yangtze River, over 6,300 kilometers long, is the third longest river in the world, with a total area of 1.8 million square kilometers, accounting for 50% of freshwater area. This is the outline of my presentation today. Number one, the basic situation of aquatic life in Yangtze River. Yangtze River is China's ecological treasury, feeding one-third of the population with over 45% of GDP. With over 1,100 aquatic species, Yangtze River's biodiversity is one of the richest in the world. Currently, as many as 92 species has been listed as endangered fish in the China Red Data Book of Endangered Animals, and near 300 species listed in the CITES Appendix. Baiji dolphin was declared as functional extinct in 2006. There only remain 1,000 Yangtze finest porpoises, and the Chinese sturgeon is extremely endangered. The flies occurrence of the four major carps has dropped from 120 billion in the 1960s to less than 1 billion of the moment. Number two, major challenges. In general, the aquatic life protection of Yangtze River faces four major problems. First, activities including hydropower projects, quarrying, dredging channel, port construction, navigation, lake reclamation, and building dams significantly affect the Yangtze River aquatic habitats. Second, Yangtze River is facing severe pollution problem. One-fifth of its river section fails to meet the third types of water quality standard. The water quality of lakes is also below the standard for four-fifths of the whole year. Third, the fishery output of the Yangtze River decreased from 450,000 tons to 80,000 tons, only 0.15% of the total output of China's aquatic products. The fourth, the high occurrence of floods, changes of hydro parameters, destroyed fishery facilities, caused high risks in fisheries. Number three, current favorable conditions for ecological protection of the Yangtze River. The government gives high priority to ecological protection. In 2017, Chinese President Xi Jinping mentioned in his work report that promote the development of Yangtze River economic belt with a method of more protection and less exploitation. Effective policy of administration. There are four documents were released on the ecological civilization and control for the Yangtze River Basin. And the third, great concern among the whole society. The public shows high concern and hopes to participate in eco-environment protection, ecological civilization construction, and the protection of the ecological environment in the Yangtze River Basin. Number four, major protective measures. One, enhance the protection of species. First is to strengthen the protection of Chinese sturgeon. We published and carried out action plan for the rescue of the Chinese sturgeon and start the restoration of living environment for Chinese sturgeon. Second is to strengthen the protection of Yangtze finest porpoise. We published and carried out action plan for the rescue of the Yangtze finest porpoise. Conduct actions for the migration protection of the Yangtze finest porpoise. Carried out the ecological scientific investigation of the Yangtze finest porpoise. Released relevant reports and raised public awareness. The third is to strengthen the protection of Spencer dibryonis. We published and carried out action plan for the rescue of Spencer dibryonis 2018 to 2035. We will promote the artificial breeding conservation of Spencer dibryonis, start the restoration of its living environment, monitor and evaluate and release Spencer dibryonis in the wild. To promote the prohibition of fishing in Yangtze River. First is to adjust and upgrade the management system during fishing moratorium. Extend the prohibition area of fishing, lengthen the period of moratorium, enforce management system during the moratorium, and organize jointly law enforcement actions. Second is to promote the experience of pilot fishermen transfer project. The first level tributary of the Yangtze River Basin will stop capture fishery, and its moratorium will last for 10 years since January 1st, 2017. Third is planning to totally ban fishing in key areas in Yangtze River Basin and help fishermen to change their jobs from the fisheries. There are more than 110,000 fishing boats in Yangtze River involving nearly 300,000 fishermen. Implement ecological rehabilitation. Carry out the reconstruction and restoration of habitats. The project to rehabilitate and rebuild fish habitats in the Yangtze River will be implemented through the promotion of ecological restoration projects. The natural habitat of the Yangtze River will be gradually restored. Implement general survey of fishery projects in protected area. Call on various regions to carry out large-scale surveys of aquatic life protection projects in protected areas. Meanwhile, the government will supervise the ratification of relevant illegal and non-compliant projects to ensure the realization of ecological functions in protected area. 4, severely crack down on illegal activities. To establish standards for the ban on fishing gear, the notice will be issued to prohibit the use of 14 kinds of fishing gear in Yangtze River Basin. Improve the ability to supervise law enforcement, setting up a special fleet of fishing administration composed of law enforcement forces, such as Fisheries Administration, Public Security, Marine Police, and the Maritime Department to intensify joint enforcement. Strengthen the construction of facilities and equipment. We will promote the construction of a law enforcement information platform for fishery law enforcement in the Yangtze River Basin. Establish a real-time supervision network through new monitoring methods. Strengthen the capacity building of law enforcement. Number five, deepening international exchanges and cooperation. We're going to organize the second session of the Yangtze River Biological Resources Protection Forum with relevant ministries and governments among the river basin, Three Gorges Group Corporation, FAO, and the World Wildlife Fund. It will be involved to jointly propose consensus and action plans that meet the requirements in the new era. We would like to welcome all colleagues to attend the forum in Wuhan City, Hubei Province this year. We will also deepen the Lansang-Mekong River cooperation mechanisms and implement the stock enhancement and fry releasing project. So wisdom will always provide better solutions, protecting the Yangtze River, building beautiful China, promoting global beauty. Thanks for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for providing that translation. Much appreciated. You as well stuck to the time limit, so you're all very punctual, which is great. Next will be the presentation that I will give on behalf of Mr. Islam Michenga from Zanzibar. He couldn't be here due to travel, last-minute travel limitations, so I will give the presentation, although I am not involved in this project. What we're going to talk about is basically the climate change impacts on the seaweed industry of Zanzibar. Zanzibar is the third largest exporter of seaweed in the world, after the Philippines and Indonesia. So it has an important holds an important place in terms of seaweed. Now, unfortunately, there's been some drastic decreases in the export of dry seaweed, as this figure shows, from 2012 to 2016. For one species, spinosum, there's a 41% decrease. For the other one, cotton eye, there's a 90% decrease. And this is, of course, impacting the worth. You know, we went from $3.9 million to $2.9 million. So, here the presenter wanted to give you a little context of the climate variability in Zanzibar. Climate is changing. They are lucky to have a 30-year observational data to base some of these conclusions from. Temperatures have increased by 5.5 degrees Celsius. Rainfall has also decreased in the two islands differently, but still decreases. The intensity of winds have increased, and sea level has also varied greatly with lower and higher peaks in the last 10 years. Events are also observed to intensify. For example, there have been record rainfalls in the span of few days ever recorded, which has caused flood events that displaced more than 10,000 people. Now there's a video that we're going to show to illustrate the problem of the seaweed of Zanzibar.
It's low tide in Zanzibar, and farmers are tending to their crops, which, on these islands off Africa's eastern coast, means seaweed. The plants that grow below the surface of these waters are harvested for an extract called carrageenan, used as a stabilizer and thickener in everything from toothpaste to chocolate milk. Seaweeds farmed for carrageenan were worth $1 billion in 2015, and Zanzibar is one of the world's top producers. But while men hold most of the jobs in this conservative Muslim society, over 80% of seaweed farmers are women. Miriam Mwazi says seaweed has given her financial independence. And according to Dr. Flower Msuya, a senior researcher at Zanzibar's Institute of Marine Sciences, Miriam's situation isn't unique.
Seaweed farming actually has changed the position of the women in the society because, you know, sometimes we say money is power.
Women's prominence in the seaweed industry was accidental. The first commercial farms set up here in the late 1980s were in the shallow waters by the beach, places already used by women in their daily activities. So while men fished in the deep sea or grew food, women reaped the benefits of the burgeoning carrageenan trade. But now, Zanzibar's seaweed and women's vital income is under threat, as warming sea temperatures attributed to climate change cause massive die-offs.
Some areas are completely affected and the seaweed doesn't grow.
In 2001, Zanzibar produced 1,048 tons of its most valuable seaweed. In 2015, it produced only 58.4 tons, a 94% drop. Dr. Islam Saloum from Zanzibar's Ministry of Agriculture says the government is trying to respond to climate change.
We have to take it very carefully and to make sure that we can adopt.
One way is to move seaweed farms out to deeper, cooler water. But that brings its own challenges. Stronger currents damage the plants, and the deep water has always been men's territory.
So now there's a shift from woman-dominated farming to men.
But Dr. Msuya is determined to keep the seaweed growing and to keep Zanzibar's women harvesting it.
These women that you see here, these are actually seaweed farmers in Mungoni village.
She's piloting a new technology for deep sea farming and making sure women, not men, pioneer it.
This is the one village in Zanzibar that continues to be able to farm the high-value species of seaweed, and that's because they're using these tubular nets, which allows them to go out into the deeper waters where it can grow.
In the deep, fast-moving water, these nets surround the seaweed so it doesn't break off and drift away.
Now we are training the women to actually make the nets using ordinary fishing nets.
To get women out where they can do their planting, Dr. Msuya provides life jackets for the farmers who can't swim, a boat to bring them out into the deeper water, and a helper to do the diving.
We have the women losing their crop, losing their income. By doing research and helping the women, I really feel that I'm fighting for gender equality.
The climate is changing. Dr. Msuya's goal is to make sure women's new role in Zanzibar does not.
Great, thank you. It's always great to get a visual when we hear of these projects that are far away, so that was very helpful. So what is FAO doing to support the seaweed problem in Zanzibar to help figure out what is going on there? There is research to understand seaweed disease and die-off in Zanzibar through a technical FAO technical cooperation project. In that project, there are basically three areas: assessment, diagnosis, and then eventually making recommendations. And I'm going to go over some of that in brief. There's also work on training on good techniques and management of seaweed farming, and also some work around product value addition. Now, what is the assessment? What is the assessment showing of the issue? There's clearly epiphyte infestation, which is associated with warm water temperatures. The occurrence of ice disease on spinosum is very high during the hot, dry season, with a decline of 90% during the wet season. During the hot, dry season, ice incidence was higher in one island with respect to the other island. And there also seems to be high temperature in the farming sites, which are likely to trigger ice occurrence, as well as bloom of the epiphytic algae. Then, of course, there's another factor which impacts epiphyte growth is high light intensity and irradiance. So the diagnosis that so far our colleagues and partners have come up with is that the rise in water temperatures could have harmful effects on the farm seaweed in Zanzibar, including the increased occurrence of disease and epiphyte infestations. Now, we want to note that the impact of global warming on cultivated seaweeds is not just particular to Zanzibar, but also to other areas of the world. So what we learn in Zanzibar can be useful to other areas. Now, the recommendations coming out of the study are the ones that you see listed here. One is to improve the genetic stock of farmed seaweed in Zanzibar. The other one is to really start looking at, as the video a little bit talked about, to pursue deep water farming systems. Another one is to make shallow lagoons a seasonal activity. And then finally, to promote the integrated multi-trophic aquaculture ecosystem-based concept in Zanzibar. And I think this is all our colleague had for the Zanzibar seaweed description. Thank you. Thank myself for those remarks, and then invite Mr. Milton Houghton up here to talk to us about the Caribbean. I used to live in Miami, so I know all about some of the issues that they've been facing over the last decade, especially the last year. So, Milton, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Okay, good afternoon. So I am from the Caribbean Regional Fisheries Mechanism, an organization that is made up of 17 Caribbean states. And I'll be talking to you a little about extreme climate-related events that we have experienced recently. Now, the Caribbean region and the small island developing states in the Caribbean are very vulnerable to the effect of climate change and the climate variability. And indeed, the climate is changing in the Caribbean region. The waters are getting warmer, especially in the past 15 years. And we are very vulnerable for a number of reasons. We have very small land masses. The population and infrastructure in the region is concentrated in the coastal areas. We are highly dependent on a few economic activities. Tourism, agriculture, fisheries are some of the few things that we have and are dependent on. We're also dependent on some vulnerable, sensitive ecosystems, such as our coral reefs. They're very, very important, and mangroves. And we also have very limited financial resources, human technical resources, and institutional capacity for climate change adaptation. So these are some of the vulnerabilities that we have. So we are at significant risk in the Caribbean, and our policymakers have recognized climate change and disaster risk management as what they call core development challenges for the region. These are things that we must deal with as a priority. Now, let me say a little about hurricanes. We have a hurricane season in the Caribbean. It runs from June to November every year. And the experts tell us that with climate change and climate variability, especially with the warming oceans, we can expect, one, more frequent hurricanes, and we can expect more intense hurricanes. And in fact, we are also seeing another very important factor that has become more prominent in recent times, and that is more rapidly intensifying storm systems. And that is actually very important, because if you're planning, in the Caribbean, if you're told that, okay, there's a Category 1 hurricane coming, I mean, that's one thing. You're not too worried about a Category 1 hurricane, because you can usually survive that. But if that hurricane will, in a very short time, intensify to become a Category 4 or 5, that's a completely different scenario. And you have to be worried. In most cases, you have to seek shelter because many of the homes cannot withstand a Category 5 hurricane. So the rapid intensification is something that is a part of the new normal environment that we're dealing with. So last year was a particularly difficult year for us in the Caribbean. We had affecting our countries two Category 5 hurricanes, Hurricane Irma and Maria. But overall in the Caribbean, we had 17 storms, 10 hurricanes and 6 major hurricanes, which is perhaps a record or close to a record year in terms of the numbers and intensity of hurricanes in the Caribbean region. Now, Hurricane Irma made landfall in the northeastern Caribbean and affected several countries, several of the small islands in the Caribbean on September 6th. And less than 2 weeks later, Hurricane Maria, which was recognized as the 10th most intense storm on record, affected more or less the same set of countries. It made landfall in Dominica on the 19th of September and caused catastrophic damage and fatalities in these countries and in the region generally. Of course, the impact varies from country to country because there's a huge difference whether or not the eye of the hurricane goes over your area or, you just experience some of the bands. Dominica and Antigua and Barbuda, Barbuda in particular, suffered immensely from these systems. In the case of Barbuda is a small island. It's a part of the nation of Antigua and Barbuda. 95% of the structures on the island were destroyed or damaged, and the entire population had to be evacuated. So the first time in over 300 years, the island of Barbuda was uninhabitable after the passage of Hurricane Irma. So that is quite a significant situation. One bright spot in terms of Barbuda, one of the few buildings that remained standing, relatively intact, was the fisheries complex that was built by the Japanese some years before. And so it became the center of reconstruction of the island. And in fact, nearly a year on, the fishers have still not gotten back their fisheries complex. So it is still being used as the center for reconstruction in the island. But that's a bright spot, the fact that one fisheries facility was able to withstand the onslaught of the hurricane. In Dominica, they suffered a lot of damage. Damage was estimated at over 224% of Dominica's GDP. The fishery sector was badly damaged, of course, agriculture and fisheries. And the fact that the fishing communities, fishers, are in the coastal areas in the land-water interface, you know, it means that they suffer a lot of damages, you know, to their homes as well as their fishing infrastructure. In Dominica, the damage was estimated at $11 million, and boats, engine gears, infrastructure, etc., all these things were severely damaged in the passage of hurricane. So, you know, it's a very difficult time for our countries that suffer. And remember, this affected several islands, not just these two that I'm focusing on. Those were the worst affected overall. And so, you know, they have to rebuild. Of course, there's no point in rebuilding what they had before, because with the next hurricane, it would be gone again. So in rebuilding, they have to look at rebuilding stronger, more robust structures and systems that can withstand these storm systems that we are told it's going to be the new norm with the warming waters, and which is fuel for these intense and more frequent systems. Okay, but these storm systems, hurricane, you know, they impact not only the land-based structure. They also have very negative impact on the ecosystems and the fisheries and living marine resources, coral reefs in particular, and the fishes that are associated with it, which are very important in the Caribbean region, are also impacted both from the wave and but also from sedimentation coming from the land and flood water loaded with debris, plastics, and all these nasty things that we know about, and toxins and so on. So these things all have an impact because they have a lot of rains and they wash everything from the land into the coastal waters. And in areas where the natural barriers, the mangrove swamps, for example, and the wetlands have been compromised, it's even worse, because these have a very important function, both in reducing the impact of the storm coming from the sea, but also in the runoff from the land going back in the coastal area. And, you know, our coral reefs have been stressed already from the warming waters. We have had coral bleaching in several areas across the Caribbean region. And these reefs are also stressed from anthropogenic activities, pollution coming from the land. So with the storms and the sedimentation, flooding and so on, it's even worse. Okay, I'm going to move on to another extreme event that we're experiencing in the Caribbean region, and that is sargassum seaweed. Since 2011, we have been having massive, massive quantities of sargassum impacting on our beaches or coastal waters and our fisheries. Now, this is a ocean-wide phenomenon, because the bloom is occurring in the southern Atlantic Ocean, and it's coming across to the Caribbean region and also impacting Western African countries at the same time. And there are a number of reasons for this, among which warming water is one theory, but also there may be others, such as increased nutrification in the waters. Sargassum is a natural system. The problem is that we are having these massive, massive blooms, and that is really the problem. And we are seeing unprecedented quantities of sargassum coming on our shore. And these are impacting fisheries. In some cases, when you have a lot, it prevents the boats from going out. Fishers just cannot go to sea. Then there is damage to engine, gears, etc. It increases operating costs when they have to travel further distances and find a path away from the sargassum in order to get to their fishing ground. And then they're also decreasing catches, because sometimes the boats, a few years ago when we had a major problem, the boats just couldn't go out. So we had like a 10 to 12,000 ton reduction in catch in Guyana alone. We're also seeing changes in species composition. The flying fish, which is very important in Barbados, is basically absent when the massive sargassum seaweed is present. And we have other species that are abundant. Dolphin fish, but juvenile dolphin fish are abundant, and the fishers have been hammering them. So we're trying to impose some precautionary measures to protect these stocks. And then there are other species that are also abundant and beneficial to the fishery. There are also some health and safety issue regarding sargassum. You know, when it rots, it produces a very pungent smell of hydrogen sulfide, and that has caused some health problems. So the lessons, and this is the final slide. Climate change and variability is a major problem, and we have been investing a lot in adaptation. We have, over the past 30 years, established a number of institutions, the Caribbean Disaster Emergency Management Agency, the Caribbean Community Climate Change Center, to spearhead activities to build resilience and promote adaptation and reduce vulnerability. But there, so a lot of efforts have gone into assessing vulnerability, building capacity, mainstreaming climate change in our policies, and mobilizing communities. However, last year showed that we are still not ready, because I mean the devastation was just so bad; it was just way beyond expectation. And so we have to refocus and intensify our efforts to adapt and to build resilience and to put ourselves in a position where we can withstand all these changes that are taking place around us. And there are a lot of things that we need to do: enhance planning and preparation, better coordination, communication, improve our baseline data and capacity, and build capacity, and providing and strengthening our insurance systems and our early warning systems, and dealing with the sargassum, which now seems to be such a serious problem. I mean, our hotels are closing because they just cannot deal with it. So there are many things that we need to do. In fisheries in particular, we have to make sure we have shelters and safe houses, stronger fishing vessels, reinforce infrastructure, good disaster risk management plans, and make sure our communities are mobilized. For example, we need to do a lot of research on the sargassum to better put ourselves in a position to deal with these things. So in a nutshell, that's the situation in the Caribbean. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Houghton. Next, I'd like to invite up Mr. Ernesto Peña Slado from DG Mare of the European Commission.
Right. Thank you very much for inviting the European Commission to this important event. I think that probably don't need to spend too much time on the first slide. Right, because you are certainly all familiar with the main conclusions of Chapter 6 of the last report of the IPCC. But I will move very quickly into what I think in this particular context is of a special relevance, which is the conclusions of the Chapter 7 of the IPCC panel on the food production systems around the world and the effects of climate change on those systems. And I want to refer not to the oceans, but to the production of food and particularly production of animal protein on land. Because if there is something that the report of the IPCC puts into perspective, is the effects of the production of food on land, and very particularly the production of animal protein, in terms of the contribution to the climate change. I think that it is well known that there are gases that contribute a lot more than CO2 to the greenhouse effect, and those gases coming largely from the production of dairy cattle. We all know that, and the IPCC panel puts this into a clear perspective, that the trying to meet the future needs of animal protein that the world needs on the basis exclusively of animal protein produced on land would have a tremendous impact in terms of the use of fresh water, the use of pesticides, the biodiversity loss in terms of the amount of additional forest that we would need to chop down in order to produce the feed crops, and the contribution of greenhouses. So that puts actually into a clear perspective the need to develop the production of seafood. The question is that if those are the negative effects of the production of food on land, is seafood any better? Well, it looks like it is somehow better. Over the last few years, there has been a development of comparative studies of the effects of different production system of animal protein on the environment using different indicators, and in particular the question of the contribution to climate change. And what we'll see, for example, is that a high meat diet produces a lot more greenhouse emissions than vegan. That seems pretty obvious. But what is important in this particular context is to see where the pescatarian diets are situated. And as you see, their effect on climate change is actually lower than diets based on meat and with very heavy consumption of meat, or even diets based on moderate in meat also have a much higher greenhouse effect than the pescatarian diet. If we look into, for example, the environmental impact using different indicators of different food production systems, and particularly the production systems for animal protein, what we see certainly is that certain types of production of animal protein, such as mollusk aquaculture or even capture fisheries for small pelagics, have the lowest impact on climate change, whereas the higher impact would be particularly on beef production and catfish aquaculture with water circulation due to the high consumption of electricity. So the message that emerges from this, the IPCC panel, and these studies that are sprouting in recent times is that if we want to meet the world's demand for animal protein, we better try to develop as much as possible the sustainable production of seafood. That's really the headline. So the question is that where are we and what are the challenges we have to face? What should we be doing in the years to come to try to meet this challenge? There is certainly a certain number of questions that I would like to touch upon very briefly. First of all, we have to ensure efficient exploitation. Manuel Barange already referred to this question. And I think that over and beyond the continuation of the fight for sustainability, which is by no means achieved and is and will continue to be a high priority for the European Union, for FAO, and for all countries around the world, we have, and we understand we have, an emerging challenge, which is not only to ensure the sustainability of the exploitation of marine resources, but also to ensure the high efficiency in the exploitation systems. Now, in certain areas of the world, we have demonstrated that fisheries management can work, that certain resources well managed are actually recovering, but that recovery is not necessarily accompanied by a high level of exploitation of those fishing possibilities. So there is a new emerging challenge that, because of a series of factors, choke species in our management systems, market failures, lack of certain commercial value for certain species, we might be even successful in bringing about recovery of fisheries resources, but we may not be meeting the challenge of ensuring that once those resources are actually recovered, we exploit them fully at sustainable levels. So we have another question, which is largely a question of culture, largely a question of markets, which is that all the experts coincide in the fact that if we have an interest to maximize the exploitation of marine resources, we should have an interest to go to give a priority for the low trophic level species. But are we doing this? Do we have the right market incentives to ensure that we exploit the marine resources in a way that corresponds to the maximum ecological effectiveness of that exploitation? Then another challenge we have is that of the physical space where the fisheries and aquaculture is taking place. We all know that not only the coasts have an increasing competition for physical space, and aquaculture already in many countries around the world suffer from this increasing competition, but now also even offshore in areas such as the North Sea, the fisheries areas are gradually being squeezed out by many other uses of the maritime space, from maritime transport to oil drilling to wind parks and so on and so forth. So the question is that if we add all these different uses of the marine environment, will we have forever the physical space we need to maximize production of seafood in a context of increasing competition for limited maritime, coastal and offshore space? Then, how will climate change affect coastal infrastructure? I think that I will not develop this because I think brilliant speakers have done this before me. Another question which is a huge challenge is that in the face of climate change, and one of the clearest conclusions of the IPCC panel, the displacement northward of the abundance of a number of species, the question is that traditional fisheries management based on traditional management areas that in many cases have been fixed for decades, are they the right way, the right instrument to try to manage species that are increasingly moving to new areas? And finally, the big question, is international governance adequate to face all these new challenges? Very briefly, just a few examples of what I'm talking about. For example, we have here in the European fisheries management system, the anchovy stock in the Bay of Biscay is regulated through a TAC only in the Bay of Biscay. But if you look at the latest distribution of the stock as determined by ICES, we see that the stock is already distributed far beyond the areas for which we have a traditional management area and a traditional TAC. So the question is that how do we need to adapt the moving resources to a management system that is fixed and has been fixed for decades? Huge challenge. A second example is the question of the competition for space. Certainly, at the level of the European Union, we believe that the spatial, maritime spatial planning is the reply. But it's not as simple as that, because it is also a question of trying to see, do we necessarily need to consider that the different uses of the maritime space are incompatible? Perhaps there is quite a lot of room to try to make those things compatible. Climate change, I think that the changing picture in terms of where the fish is poses an entirely new challenge too, which is that the current status quo in terms of how the cake is distributed is already questioned by many countries. How are we going to deal with a situation where the fish is moving and altering even that already questioned status quo? That certainly requires... Then I know that I have to shut up very quickly. Then are RFMOs ready for a picture which is not one that is fixed for decades? The RFMOs traditionally manage fisheries in certain areas that haven't changed for so many years. Now we have an increasing number of transboundary species. The RFMO will have to cooperate a lot more to try to deal with transboundary effects and transboundary species. And last but not least, all that can be summarized in one headline: facing the challenge of climate change in the world fisheries and aquaculture requires fundamentally more and better global governance, which is what the European Union has launched last year. And we successfully understand that this is necessary for many reasons, including a fundamental one: facing the challenges of climate change. Thank you.